Blog Talk Radio.
A long time ago, on a gloomy, wet Cleveland spring night, two men stand alone amidst the late night drizzle. Their voices echo across the vacant station parking lot as they debate the merits of the great American radio show that have been missing for far too long. On that night, an idea was born. That idea became the FDH Lounge. Welcome to the FDH Lounge.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the FDH Lounge. This is FDH Managing Partner Rick Morris welcoming you to FDH Lounge, mini episode number 145. We've got a great one for you here today. Two gentlemen are going to be joining us, a father and son team. You can check out their work at WinstonChurchillThrillers.com. It details the books that they've written. There is the latest out in their series of Winston Churchill Thrillers. We're going to be discussing that one here today, and it is going to be a real pleasure to get into this. We have had on the FDH Lounge one of our greatest months, I have to say. If you look at the last week alone, showing that we truly are the show where nothing is off topic, the variety that we have had from our NBA draft preview to an interview with pro wrestling legend Tully Blanchard of the famed Four Horsemen to Russ Mitchell, newsman at CBS, who left to take a local job in Cleveland, Ohio at WKYC, the NBC affiliate, getting to sit down with him personally and now moving to speaking with these gentlemen here tonight, one of whom actually coincidentally, like myself, a native of the Cleveland area. That would be Michael McMenamin, his son Patrick McMenamin, joining us also. These two gentlemen together, again, have penned this series of thrillers, and we're discussing their latest effort, the Gemini Agenda, which has been, which is available, of course, and you can find out more information at WinstonChurchillThrillers.com. Unlike some past times with the show, we actually did not get a chance to screen a copy of the book ahead of time, so please bear with me on this. I think I was able to find enough information off of their website and through other channels. They actually have a YouTube trailer for it, which I have to say is the first I've seen for a newly released book, a good way of disseminating information also. Michael McMenamin, as I said, a Cleveland native, a longtime lawyer, contributor to Reason Magazine and former Army counterintelligence officer. His son, Patrick McMenamin, co-author of the book, longtime producer at presently at Fox Business Network. And again, these gentlemen together putting these this series of books together, the latest, of course, being the Gemini Agenda. I believe it was Michael that was to join us first here, so we'll be going to the Alliance to bring him in. Michael, is that you?
It is. It is, Rick.
Michael, welcome to the program, sir. Good
Thank
to have you.
You
on.
Thank you. Let me correct something, though.
Sure.
Patrick is a Cleveland native.
Okay.
He was born in Cleveland and grew up in Shaker Heights.
Okay.
I've lived in Cleveland for 40 years. Patrick and his sisters all live in New York, and they still own Cleveland Browns season tickets.
Okay.
So
okay. Well, I guess it depends on how you define native, and I would be the last man to argue with a lawyer, sir, so no question about that. Interestingly enough, and I don't know, I'm sure this has come up around Patrick's office, one of his office mates over there, a Cleveland native as well, at least she worked here for a period of time, Liz Klayman, one of our favorite recurring guests here on the FDH Lounge, so we'll have to have Patrick give a shout-out to her on our behalf.
Great.
Yeah, that a lot of folks have passed through the Cleveland area, and in his case, moved on to New York and gone on to do great things. This series of books, again, very interesting from the research that we were doing on them here. I have to tell you, presently, I know I'm very late to the party on this, getting caught up in watching the Deadwood episodes, but it sort of put me in mind of what you guys are doing here. You're mixing actual historical figures with folk with characters that you guys are creating. So I guess we could start by talking about that, the balance that you're trying to achieve. Obviously, you're trying to be true to Winston Churchill and anybody else that the characters were based on while still being able to tell your own story.
Well, yes. Actually, if any of your listeners are fans of Ken Follett, Ken Follett's book, The Man from St. Petersburg, is kind of the template we follow. The Man from St. Petersburg was set in 1914, involved in Russian anarchist attempt to assassinate a Russian prince in London, and Winston Churchill was the catalyst in that book. He wasn't the protagonist, but he was the catalyst. He set things in motion, he kept things going, against the backdrop of otherwise a fictional story. And so we've created two characters, fictional characters. One of them is a lawyer, former Army counterintelligence agent named Burke Cochran Jr. And he is the fictional son of Churchill's real-life mentor, a New York congressman, lawyer, orator named Burke Cochran, about which I wrote a book, Becoming Winston Churchill, The Untold Story of Young Winston and His American Mentor. And we wanted to create an Indiana Jones-like character who had a real connection with Churchill. And so for our hero's father to have been Churchill's mentor is how he and Churchill get together. And then we wanted a female protagonist as well, and so we gave Churchill a fictional Scottish goddaughter, Mattie McGarry, whom Churchill in the first book brings together, and their romance continues through the next three books.
Interesting. Well, as a writer myself, I find that methodology to be very intriguing as far as how you came up with the characters. And again, I had seen an interview that you had done previously. I believe it was with Nick Gillespie. I saw it on YouTube when you were talking about Winston Churchill's American mentor, and to develop a fictional son off of him is certainly an interesting twist. I'm wondering also, too, that for as much intrigue as these books involve in international circles, I'm guessing to whatever degree your time in counterintelligence probably played a part in your perspective and in developing what the characters are going through.
Not really.
Okay. Faulty assumption.
I mean, Army counterintelligence agent, which is what I was. It sounds good. My publisher hasn't put it down there, but you know, I was only in it for 3 years, and it wasn't very exciting.
Okay.
It was kind of boring stuff, but it sounds good on my resume, and so I agree with my publisher to go ahead and do it. No, I'm a fan of thrillers, and they always tell beginning writers to write about what you like. Well, I like thrillers. I love Robert Ludlum. The titles to our books are all homage to Robert Ludlum's books. And, you know, one reviewer got our books down in one phrase: Winston Churchill meets Indiana Jones. And that's what we're trying to do. These books are set in the 1930s when Churchill was out of power, his wilderness years, 1929 to 1939, and a lone voice warning against the rise of Hitler and Nazi Germany. And therefore, you will find at various places in all of our books Nazis as villains. They're perfect villains. But we try and weave in historical characters. I think the first book, William Randolph Hearst is in all books, because Mattie McGarry, our female protagonist, is a photojournalist who works for Hearst, even though she's Scottish. He's in all the books. Winston is in all the books. Cochran, well, he starts out as a law professor. He is also of counsel to Wild Bill Donovan in his law firm. And so Wild Bill Donovan is a character in all the books. And then depending upon what the storyline is, we have various and sundry historical figures. I think Herbert Hoover is in the first book. Adolf Hitler actually has speaking roles in all three books, because you can't really write about Winston Churchill without taking into account Adolf Hitler.
Well, very interesting that you've got a Wild Bill in there, and you've got a member of the Hearst family tied in. There's actually two parallels to Deadwood, however faint they may be, although I'm guessing that the language in these books is better and at least less anachronistic than from the Deadwood TV show. But I'm curious historically also, too, how this parallels Winston Churchill's actual progression vis-a-vis his thoughts on the Nazis, his awareness, his alarm of the looming threat. Obviously, that was developing during the 1930s. How closely do your novels track that, or is there a little bit of writer's license in there in terms of the timeline?
Well, there's always author's license. In fact, I'm appearing on a panel at Thriller Fest in New York in July on the perils of using actual historical characters as fictional characters. But with respect to Churchill, since I'm a Churchill scholar, since I'm on the editorial board of Finest Hour, which is the quarterly journal of the Churchill Center, I'm very conscious writing Winston that people who really know Churchill are going to be reading my books and letting me know if I get it wrong. So, Churchill is as close to accurate as I can get. When you place a real character in a fictional situation, you have to be true to him. And Churchill was worried about Hitler from the first time the Nazis became the second largest party in Germany, which was August of 1930. So he was aware of the peril of Hitler and the rise of the Nazis from the very beginning. In fact, our first three books take place between 1929 and the end of 1932. So it's, those three books, the first trilogy, take place during the 3 years leading to Hitler taking power. Our next three books, we're almost through with the fourth. We're outlining the fifth. That'll take place over the next 2 years, 33, 34, maybe 35. But I try and keep very accurate when it comes to Churchill. In fact, I try and be accurate with all the historical characters, although I have a viewpoint. I Herbert Hoover doesn't come across too well in the first book. but it's a fair viewpoint. FDR is not a character yet, but he is a character in the fourth book. It's just fun to use historical characters. We don't use historical characters unless we have read at least one, if not two or three biographies of the historical characters. So you have a feel for how the historical character is going to react in a fictional situation.
Well, there are a couple notes there were very commendable. One being, again, that Churchill's awareness of the Nazi threat predated their taking power that early, a good 2 to 3 years. I didn't realize that that was the case. So tremendous foresight on his part. And as far as it goes with you also, too, again, there is writer's license, and you have to be willing to do that, I suppose. But it can get distracting, and so it's good if you can keep that to a minimum. So your description of the accuracy of the timeline, I'm sure, just enhances the pleasure of the readers as they're going through it. But as you were talking about the social and literary circles there of fellow Winston Churchill scholars, admirers, fans, whatever you want to call it, to what degree have you relied on picking the brains of your fellow enthusiasts going through and bouncing ideas off of them? Well, we're always very fascinated on this show about the creative process, so that's a question that comes to my mind. Well, when you're talking to these folks all the time who share your love of Winston Churchill?
My editor at Finest Hour, Richard Langworth, is probably, outside of Martin Gilbert, Churchill's official biographer, one of the most knowledgeable people in the world on Churchill. And he's a sounding board on a number of things. I also use a professor in California, David Freeman. In fact, he looked at a manuscript, and I had Churchill drinking whiskey and water, and he wrote back and said, no, whiskey and soda. And I said, okay, and I changed it to whiskey and soda. And mind you, Churchill has a reputation as being a heavy drinker, which is not really true, but he would drink on a regular basis. His favorite drink was champagne, but he would work during the mornings with a very weak whiskey and water, a habit he acquired in India because he used a little bit of whiskey to mask the taste of the water, which wasn't that good in India. Anyway, minor things like that are important. And so, yes, I do have Churchill scholars I call upon.
Water wasn't that good in India. Well, the more things change, the more they stay the same, I suppose. But that's an interesting note as far as how he handled that and what his course was on that. I think also in looking at this too, it's going to be a note of interest to people that vis-a-vis some of the different projects being developed right now. You look at the Hatfields and the McCoys on History Channel and some of the things like that. I'm curious whether you and your son have ever considered leveraging this perhaps in new media with some kind of a production, perhaps traditional television. Have you guys looked to take this franchise beyond the book form?
That's Patrick's job.
He's
the one in television, and actually he's been a television news producer for about 8 years. He started at ABC with John Stossel, moved with Stossel to Fox Business Network. Then he was senior producer for Freedom Watch Judge Napolitano, and actually he's no longer at Fox Business since Judge Napolitano's show was canceled, and he's now working for the Huffington Post, which is starting in July, I believe, a 12-hour daily news talk video program, and that's in a startup, which is probably why Patrick hasn't joined us yet today. But no, Patrick's in charge of the media end of things. His wife Becca is a film makeup artist. She was a head makeup artist on Law and Order SVU. She was a makeup artist last season on Smash. Her cousin David Benioff is the executive producer of Game of Thrones. So it's that side of the family that's in charge of getting us out of print and into media.
Oh, okay. So that is a thrust then of this thing potentially. So using those, I'm not going to say connections per se. That would have a certain connotation to it. But whatever avenues that have become available over a period of time, this is something you guys are considering. That's very intriguing because I could see it lending itself well to a History Channel project or the like. It would be very intriguing to consider it in that form.
Rick, that's what family's for.
Well, excellent. Everybody heard it here first as far as that goes, when and if that comes to fruition, and we can only hope. But as far as, let's take a step backwards here to the decision on this, and basically from some reading that I've done, I have come across some of the basics, but I think it would be interesting and very edifying for the listeners to hear the story. When you and your son came up with the idea to do this together, I saw in some reading that I was doing, you guys alluding to family dinners where perhaps some other eyes were rolling at the thought of all the Churchill talk. But I'm very interested to hear, as I think others would be, the process by which you guys decided to create this franchise.
Well, the concept originally came from me because I've been studying Churchill and writing about him for quite some time, for probably 20 years. And, I've been a writer for a long time. I've been with Reason since 75 and since Finest Hour since, the late 80s. And, so I always wanted to do fiction. And, Ken Follett's book, The Man with St. Petersburg, inspired me. And I thought, I can do that, maybe. And the period I wanted to focus on, the period I find most fascinating in Churchill's life, is the wilderness years, 29 to 39. And Patrick and I, when he was growing up, we used to love to watch not only Indiana Jones, but the George Lucas ABC television series, Young Indiana Jones Chronicles, which also helped us form our ideas, because if you saw that show, and it was on for like 3 or 4 seasons, it was really good. And Young Indiana Jones, Sean Patrick Flannery, would interact with, in the stories, real historical characters. And it was well-researched, well-done, and we thought, let's do that. And so we did. And Churchill, you know, most people think of Winston saving the world in 1940, standing up to Hitler. But he was an adventurous, athletic guy. I mean, he fought in Afghanistan on the northwest border. He fought Muslim terrorists in the Sudan. He was in the Boer War, taken prisoner of war, escaped from Pretoria, made his way over 250 miles of Boer territory to freedom. He was a seaplane pilot. When he was first Lord of the Admiralty, he learned to fly a seaplane in 1912. Planes were very dangerous back then. He was a crack shot all his life. As I say, he played polo until he was 20. He was a fencing champion in high school. Very athletic, very energetic, adventure-seeking guy. And I can tell you, he is just pleased as punch to be in an adventure series set in the 1930s. In fact,
I can well imagine that, Michael. And in terms of that, again, I know it's not during the time frame that these books are set to, but as I was going through, as I was doing a little bit of prep for this, it's been a few years at least since my days as a history minor down at the Harvard on the Hocking. But as I was going through and prepping and looking at this and reading about those military adventures of which you speak, to what extent is that leveraged in the course of this, be it Churchill speaking of those times, memories from it, lessons learned, et cetera?
Well, I was kind of cautious. We were kind of cautious in the first book where Churchill was the subject of an assassination attempt, and we didn't let him take part in the culmination of where an attack is made on this IRA warehouse, and he was upset about that. And then in the second book, they're off to rescue Maddie, who was being held by the Nazis, and Winston came along for that, but he wasn't actually involved in the gunplay, and he was annoyed with that too. And so in our third book, we actually let him show what a marksman he was, because as they're trying to get away in an airplane where Churchill was the co-pilot, and someone said, "You? When was the last time you flew?" And he said, 1912, but you never forget. and so the Nazis are coming on to the airfield, and Churchill and one of the other guys, not Cochrane, are attempting with 45 automatics to stop this car, and the other guy is an Irish guy, and he's a very good shot, he's waiting to he's waiting for the Nazis to get close enough. And with 45 automatics, the optimum range with real accuracy is like 50 yards.
Mm-hmm.
And so Bobby Sullivan is a guy's name, and he's in all three books. And he was an assassin for Michael Collins in the Irish Anglo War, and he's waiting for the car to get 50 yards away. Churchill is standing beside him, and he starts blasting away at 75 yards, promptly puts three shots right in the middle of the Mercedes radiator. And, you know, the car comes to a halt, and Bobby Sullivan takes out the Nazis inside. And so afterwards, they're taking off, and Sullivan comes up to to Churchill in the cockpit, and he says, "Mr. Churchill, I've never seen such remarkable marksmanship." And Churchill, you know, scar in his eyes, mouth, turns around and says, "Nonsense. How could anyone guess a Mercedes radiator at 75 yards? Now, I tell you what, putting a bullet into the eye of a charging black rhino or a lion or a rhinoceros, That's marksmanship. And then he turns and smiles and says, of course I've done that too. Which in fact he has. Churchill actually bagged a white rhino in Africa in 1908. And Theodore Roosevelt was very jealous because he tried and never bagged a white rhino. So in any event, Winston is very pleased with the third book and the role we gave him because he thinks that's accurate. Churchill was a crack shot. He carried a weapon with him almost at all times, and he practiced. He had a shooting range set up at his country home, and he practiced once a week, right up through the war.
Interesting. Well, I got to tell you, Michael, I'm smelling prequels here. You know, you can go back and trace Winston Churchill's military career while you're at it. I should note that in our remaining 2 to 3 minutes here, we do have, I see that we are joined on the phone lines by the other co-writer here of the book, Patrick McMenamin. So I think what I'll just do is turn the floor over to you, Patrick, and whatever you think is most noteworthy about this book and any of the other ones in the series, please take it away.
Oh, hi there. Sorry I'm so late. I just made it in time, thankfully. Well, I don't know what my father's been saying about me in my absence, so it's hopefully it's all good things.
I didn't tell them, Patrick, about how we write the books together, so you might do that.
Okay. I can do that. Well, you know, my joke answer is that my dad writes them and I make them readable. It was a pretty organic process how we got started. This was originally a project my dad had, and I was originally just sort of helping edit, and then we just went back and forth. I started rewriting chapters, passages and entire chapters, and eventually, before I knew it, I was writing the book with him. And as we started planning future novels, I would specifically pick one story arc of a character and basically write all the chapters of that character. My dad would write the others, and then we just trade them back and forth and edit them until you really can't tell who started which chapter. And that way it's nice. It gives us both a sense of ownership, a little freedom, and because naturally, I mean, if anyone is listening to this has ever, you know, tried to write something with anybody, it's a really challenging thing to work out and still be friends, let alone with your own father, especially when your father pens sex scenes and you have to edit them very often. but somehow we find a way to muddle through, and it's a pretty fun process, honestly, to work on a book with your dad and still be friends.
Well, it's a tremendous story of how this is coming together, as well as the stories themselves. And your father had touched upon the prospects for multimedia perhaps at some point down the road. So we look forward to seeing this in whatever form that it manifests itself as these projects go along. Gentlemen, it's been great talking to both of you here today, and Michael and Patrick McMenamin. And again, we'd love to do it again anytime. And now, Michael, with you being in the Cleveland area, I'd love to sit down with you personally sometime, perhaps with your work about at Reason Magazine or anything else that you've got going on. So you guys are always welcome back.
Great. Thanks very much, Rick. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much. Thanks so much for having us. Appreciate it.
Thank you, gentlemen, so much. And thank you for joining us out there in the audience here, FDH Lounge, mini episode 145.